Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, Brexit. On June 23rd, voters in the UK chose by a 52-48 margin to leave the European Union, an entity that the country has long had problems with. I have problems with it too. It's unabashedly neoliberal and often quite undemocratic. But the movement to leave came from the right, which circulated phantasmic notions of what this assertion of national sovereignty would do. Some people on the left supported it because it would allegedly make space for a future social democratic or socialist government to make policy more freely. But given the horrid tone of the campaign and the bigotry it's unleashed, I'd say it was a misreading of the political horizon. In any case, here are two UK-based analysts to give us their perspectives, Alan Finlayson and Priyamvada Gopal, both making return appearances in Behind the News. First, Alan Finlayson, a professor of political and social theory at the University of East Anglia. Finlayson was on this show back in 2013 to discuss Bonoism, the ideology of the lead singer of U2, an ideology that, for all its purported humanitarianism, is fundamentally conservative, one that Finlayson characterizes as an individualized and self-aggrandizing politics. Finlayson runs a website on British political rhetoric and had a piece on open democracy on the taxonomy of support for and opposition to Brexit. Alan Finlayson. Welcome, Alan. First of all, what was your position on the Remain or Leave referendum?
I was a Remain supporter and a Remain voter, although I did think for a while that Leave would win.
Why did you take the Remain position?
Several reasons. One of them is, in a way, agreement with part of what the Remain campaign was arguing, that the fallout of Brexit economically is going to be severe, I think, and I think that's already showing itself, and I don't think the country is in a position to deal with that kind of crisis at the moment. And allied to that, I don't think that the left is in any position to capitalise on the economic crisis that Brexit is leading to, nor on the political crisis. I think that's where a lot of the dispute was between people on the left who were thinking about whether to support Remain or Leave. Some thought that this would produce opportunities for the left. My view was that it would not. The left is just too weak and the chances of the right seizing the agenda are too high. And it was clear for the campaign that part of what was happening was that the Leave campaign was tapping into anti-immigrant and racist sentiment. And I think that just had to be opposed.
From this distance, it seemed like I didn't really understand what the left or the Lexiters were going after. It seemed to me that the campaign was, from the first, really dominated by reactionary, xenophobic themes, and it seemed very impossible to hijack that train once it was underway. Am I missing something from across the Atlantic?
Yeah, I think that was a clear element of the campaign, although people might argue the extent to which that was the centre or the sole part of the campaign. I think from the, I don't really want to put words in the mouths of Lexit supporters, but I think the view was partly that the EU is such a restrictive neoliberal institution that it cannot be transformed or changed, therefore getting out of it is worth it, whatever the costs, and we can deal with that fallout later. I think there was also an argument, not entirely false argument, that some of the anti-Europe sentiment, including that which might get mopped up by racist rhetoric, some of that sentiment has a just complaint about the effects of neoliberalism and globalisation upon it. So some perhaps thought there was a more of a moral reason to support it. But I think the main thing was people thinking that this would lead to a situation that could be capitalised on by the left.
Again, from this distance, it seems like neoliberalism in Britain has been a project of people with names like Thatcher, Blair, and Cameron. And the contribution of Brussels seems highly secondary to me.
That would be my reading, absolutely, that Britain was not suffering under a neoliberal yoke that it didn't want to suffer under. It was driving forward that project, and in some respects, the conflict between British governments and the EU was because the British governments wanted to be more neoliberal. For that reason, it didn't seem to me that Leave was going to open up any space for a significant and well-organised anti-neoliberal movement.
And what identifiable harm has the EU caused Britain in any substantial way?
There is a strong case to be made by those on the left that the EU does write into its principles and practices, resistance to certain forms of social democratic amelioration of capitalism, that it does prevent the free movement for potential social democratic governments when it comes to redistribution or renationalization of key industries and to support for national state industries. So part of the EU project limits the extent to which governments can bail out their own industries. That they would justify that by saying that's about creating a level playing field, not enabling protectionist practices within the EU. But many people, understandably on the left, chafe against that and see that as something that blocks the free movement of a potential socialist government. That was always the objection from the left to the EU way back in the 1970s, that it would hamper the free movement and free action of a socialist government or social democratic government should it be brought to power. And there is some justice in that. And of course, the EU is also heavily implicated in things like TTIP, so again, you know, carrying through and implementing very neoliberal systems of regulation. And many people in the UK also reacted against the way in which the EU behaved towards Greece over the Greek crisis. So even though the Greeks were keen on staying in the EU and some of the Greek parties wanted Britain to stay in the EU, some British left people thought that was just evidence of the extent to which the EU would never allow any kind of alternative to grow within it. The British leaving would not only increase the chances of left-wing developments in the UK, but also might precipitate further decline and damage in the EU, therefore allowing more left-wing movements to develop. And I can see why that argument might work in the abstract, but as I say, my judgment was that in the current moment, given the state of organisation and capacity of left organisations and the extent to which in this country Brexit was capitalising on racist sentiment, I just didn't think that was a good case to support.
What about the class dimensions of the support? Was it a working class protest vote? I've seen really conflicting evaluations of that. What's your position?
So you can certainly make the case that a lot of support was what one might think of as working class. There's strong evidence that the geographical distribution of support for Brexit does map onto those areas that would have been strongly working class in the 1970s and 80s, areas of old industries, shipping, docks, fishing, mining and so forth, all these kinds of areas which would have been strong Labour Party supporting areas for a long time. These voted strongly for Brexit, and that's something that's been coming for a long time in terms of the rising support in those areas for the United Kingdom Independence Party, which is one of the main advocates of anti-European sentiment. So you can see that, but I think it's a much more complicated picture because not all working class areas voted in the same degree for Brexit. And the Brexit coalition, if you like, is also made up of very non-working class elements. So the county I live in the UK is called Norfolk. It's a very rural farming constituency, but also has a lot of very wealthy people, very wealthy retired people, and that voted uniformly, apart from my little town of Norwich, that voted uniformly for Brexit. So it's really an alliance between different class groups, if you like, what some people call the left behind working class, with this kind of petty bourgeois to kind of retired bourgeois constituency, often older in age as well. But I guess I could also say, to be a little bit more abstract, when we talk about it being working class, we might want to say it may be support from people who could be sociologically allocated to the working class. It's not at all clear to me that there was any kind of working class consciousness motivating the support for Brexit. Much more of a nationalist consciousness or a collection of grievances and resentments about the situation people find themselves in after 30 years of deindustrialisation and whatever it is now, 7-8 years of post-crash economic slump.
I found it striking that it seems unlikely that a motion to leave the EU would pass in Greece or Portugal, countries that have been very demonstrably harmed by the EU. And it did in Britain, a country which has really not suffered much damage at the hands of the EU. Do you have any explanation for why that might be?
Yeah, so it does seem really ironic, doesn't it, that the UK was well understood as being one of the big three countries in the EU, along with France and Germany, one of the more powerful countries, both economically and politically, and one of the countries most benefiting from some of the economic free movement that it allowed, and from as well as from some of the redistribution of funding that it encouraged. So the reason why is there are many reasons along all sorts of kinds of levels. Some of them are to do with a much deeper historical disconnection between the UK, England, and Europe in general, right? There's a long historical difference between the UK and the continent in terms of attitudes towards politics, law, and so forth. You know, we are part of the same Anglo-Saxon world of capitalism as you are, rather than the more specific continental German Franco model. But I think to come to the more contemporary period, it's a number of things. Firstly, it's that British politicians have for a long time used the EU as an excuse. So they have used the claim that the EU forced them to do things as an excuse for doing things that either the EU didn't force them, or they would have done anyway, or that they in fact participated in encouraging the EU to do. So that kind of farming out of responsibility for political decisions has meant that many people have directed their resentment at the EU rather than at the UK. But I think it's also to do with the way that the campaign was in some respects not about the EU at all. Certainly the Leave side of the campaign managed to make voting for leaving the EU stand for this whole range of different resentments that were not necessarily directly connected to the EU, but were much more broadly about what's happened to people over the last 30, 40 years. And in doing that, they really made a referendum on, you know, how do you feel? How angry are you? Are you as mad as hell and not going to take it anymore? And that was what won it for them. There is a more specific kind of anti-European attitudes within the upper echelons of the Conservative Party, but maybe we can talk about that in a bit.
Please do.
If you want to understand what shapes the ideology of the upper echelons of the Conservative Party, I think you have to see that there are really two broad constituencies, both of which had Eurosceptic sentiments, but for very different reasons. So there's one part of the Conservative Party which is quite traditionally motivated. It wants to protect English-British traditions. It's hostile to the tendency for government intervention that's characteristic of, say, Germany and France and the EU more broadly, and wants to defend the traditional nation-state. That's one key constituency of conservative Euroscepticism. But there's another side to that, which is what some people call the kind of hyper-globalists, whose problem with the EU is not that it's imposing neoliberalism or restricting or opening up the nation state and eroding it. It's that it's not eroding the nation state enough, and it's not imposing and developing neoliberalism fast enough. Their view is that really the EU is an outdated project that allows states to protect certain kinds of markets, including labour markets, that protect certain kinds of national cultures and characteristics, that is too concerned to try and impose cultural harmonisation between people. And they really want to open British economy and British society up much further to a new hyper-capitalist 21st century technology-driven low regulation marketplace. So those two constituencies came together in the Conservative Party and have driven Euroscepticism within it for the last 20, 25 years. And together they have managed to mobilise some of the popular support for Euroscepticism, as well as the United Kingdom Independence Party, which from outside of the Conservative Party has pushed Euroscepticism as part of a more broadly populist far-right strategy.
I'm Sugath Alan Finlayson, a professor of political and social theory at the University of East Anglia. Usually libertarians here, you think, are very interested in the free movement of people would be loath to clamp down on immigration. How about these elite leavers that you were talking about?
When I say they're libertarian, I don't think they're quite as libertarian in quite the way of the US Libertarian Party, at least as I see it represented, which seems to be a mixture of kind of pure freedom claimers and kind of kooks. They're more like the kind of libertarians on the West Coast, the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, the people who think that it would be great to plant their own island in the sea and be free of any interference, the Ayn Rand fans. So as well as being libertarian, they're also elitists. They're also inegalitarians. They don't believe that people are or should be equal. They do believe that the people who are more able, more innovative, more entrepreneurial, more industrious and so forth, those are the people who should be encouraged and facilitated and freed to develop and manage whatever kinds of high-tech wonders they can dream up. So when it comes to immigration, what they want is to not be required, as they are under EU law, to let anybody from the EU come in who wants to come in. They want to be able to pick and choose from all over the world who is and who isn't going to come in, either the great geniuses of the future or those who will build the great glass skyscrapers that the geniuses will live in. So I think they want to be able to pick cheap labour where they can get cheap labour from, not give them much in terms of rights or protection, so they can go away again when they finish building those kinds of skyscrapers. So I sometimes call it, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but I think there's a kind of dream of a sort of Dubaization or a Singaporeization of London that some of them fantasize about.
The results of this referendum are breaking apart the two major parties, aren't they?
Yeah, at the moment, things are very fast moving. I don't know what's happened since I started talking to you. The Conservative Party itself is going to be very split because the Conservative Party also has a constituency of people who are committed to the EU project, seeing it as an instance of good governance, and who also think that the economic chaos Brexit is wreaking is not a price worth paying. So there's tensions within the Conservative Party between all these different kinds of factions. And David Cameron, in announcing his resignation immediately after we found out the result of the referendum, has thrown the party somewhat into chaos. It's really thrown back on those who led the Leave campaign from the Conservative Party the responsibility to sort out what on earth happens now. So there's going to be a summer in which candidates of various kinds contend to replace Cameron. And there's going to be, I suspect, some kind of opposition to those who led the Brexit campaign from those who were opposed to it.
And what about the Labour Party?
The Labour Party, faced with the opportunity to stand up as a coherent opposition to a chaotic and self-destructive Conservative Party, has done what it always does, which is turn in on itself. There were calls almost immediately after the result was announced for the resignation of the Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. So what's going on there is partly just the people who never liked Jeremy Corbyn as leader seizing their moment to try and overthrow him. Ever since he became party leader, he's faced a lot of opposition from within the parliamentary Labour Party, from the older Blairites, who were never at all in favour of the membership selection of him as Labour Party leader. There's also suspicion, I suppose you could say, on their part, that he was never particularly in favour of the European Union in the first place, and as a consequence didn't really play as dynamic and focused a role in the campaign as he might have done. So they blame him for the referendum result not going the way it could have done.
You're a specialist in political rhetoric. Could you comment on the rhetorical strategies of the two sides of this campaign?
The key slogan for the Leave campaign was vote Leave, take control. That idea of control definitely took hold in the campaign and became one of the most significant concepts at play within it. And I think it worked because the idea of control was something that different people could apply to different aspects of their lives or different forms of politics. So it helped shape a very broad constituency of people who could vote Leave. So for some, it meant very specifically, I think, take control of borders, prevent immigration, restrict immigration. For others, it might have a more narrow personal meaning, take control of your business, be free of the regulations that are imposed on you by bureaucrats. For others, it might have had a more principled democratic feel to it, take control, be more self-determining. For others, I think it had very much an anti-politics feel. Take control back from the politicians who've screwed us in all these ways, who've bailed out the banks and not helped us. And I wonder if it didn't also have a more kind of existential meaning for people who do feel out of control in their lives because all of these things are happening economically, socially, perhaps culturally, that they don't feel they have any say over or any sway over. They feel things are just being done to them, as I suspect some of the kind of Trump supporters feel. So vote Leave, take control appealed to them as a kind of act of resistance in that sort of a way. I think that was also for the Leave campaign, it was also allied to a sense of what I would call a kind of conspiracy theory, without wanting to play that too much. I don't mean people believed in lizards or the Illuminati, but that sense that there are people out there, them who are doing everything, the elites, the liberal intelligentsia, the intellectuals, the experts. A large part of the Leave campaign was about refuting anything that any expert ever said. Every economist was in the pay of somebody or being supported by the EU. Every international body had its own agenda. When Obama said he thought Britain should stay in the EU, the leader of the Leave campaign, Boris Johnson, said, well, he was just exercising resentment on behalf of his Kenyan father and doesn't like England at all for these kinds of reasons. So they fed also that sense of amorphous forces out there who are doing everything, and you could kind of take control back from them. And in contrast to that, Remain had a really kind of very flat rhetorical appeal, partly because it just relied on the endless recitation of statistics that become numbing after a while, but really because it tried to construct an argument on the basis of a very thin utilitarianism. It tried to appeal to people's self-interest and say, if we leave the EU, your self-interest will be harmed. There'll be less money for this. There'll be less protections for that. They ended up producing quite a great long list of things that would be worse if we left the EU. Protections for the environment, free movement across the country, roaming charges for your cell phone across Europe, this sort of thing. That got very quickly dubbed Project Fear by the opponents. So they were able to say, you're just trying to scare us and we won't be scared. So they could claim kind of bravery on the Leave side. And it failed to inspire people with any sense of what might be gained by remaining in the EU. It didn't have any existential appeal that made people feel like they were doing something meaningful with their vote. So it just failed to inspire people. And I think also for a lot of people, the suggestion that you were going to lose money or lose wealth or lose status by leaving the EU just had no appeal for people who feel like they've lost everything already anyway.
I guess, you know, what you describe as a rhetorical strategy of the Remain people sort of reflects the fact that the EU has been a very technocratic project all along.
Yes, it has been a technocratic project. There is, the democratic deficit is something that people complain about a lot. It's also something that governments over the decades have not sought to inspire much in the way of love for or encourage people to feel attached to. And the EU itself doesn't always inspire that precisely because it is kind of bureaucratic and technocratic in the way in which it behaves. There's a lot of people now saying, how is it that the areas of the country which voted most heavily to leave the EU, there's quite a strong correlation between that and those areas of the country that have in fact received most money from the EU in terms of funds to develop infrastructure, roads, and in some cases training facilities and FE colleges and so forth. Places that had, because they were underdeveloped or economically depressed, received quite a lot of money, yet these places voted against the EU. And that may reflect the sense in which being the recipient of handouts doesn't necessarily make one feel grateful. It can make one feel out of control, under the thumb of or being pat on the head by distant sorts of authorities. And certainly in this country, the EU hasn't managed to build up a kind of popular sentiment behind it that would make people feel that it was anything other than this anonymous body.
Okay, and so what does all this mean for Bono?
I didn't see Bono very much in the campaign, but I imagine Bono would have been a Remain voter. But there is, I think, a connection with what I've elsewhere called Bonoism. If Bono represents the kind of attitude of we creative, clever, artistic people, if we just put our heads together, we can change the world and we can make everything in our own image. That kind of other individualized, self-aggrandizing politics, actually that is partly represented, I think, in some of the libertarian techno-enthusiasts who think that if we can just throw off the shackles of the European Union, then they can put their great minds to work and solve all of our country's problems. But of course they don't make quite so clear is that that means us doing what they want us to do, and what it means is the great freedom and creativity that they so desire will be theirs. It won't necessarily be ours.
That was Alan Finlayson, a professor of political and social theory at the University of East Anglia. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Tomorrow morning I must work, I know that you'll be gone. For those in peril on the seaside, put your faith on hold. Blessed to vanish with a warning, I'll land out of control. Deep and still, blood on the water, things unsaid, hold them in our hands.
I was some of Fear and Beer, Hymn for Brexit, by the Mekons, posted to YouTube on Wednesday. The note below the video says, here's a hymn for the post-factual democracy sung joyously by the disenchanted and forgotten as they tumble teary-eyed into the arms of their oppressors. We'll hear another bit from at the end of the show. Now, Priyam Vada Gopal. Priya teaches English at Cambridge University. She's been on this show before to discuss the fascism behind the neoliberal facade of Narendra Modi, the Hindu fundamentalist Prime Minister of India. Here she is to talk about the propaganda campaign around Brexit and the license it's given to xenophobes and yahoos to amp up their bigotry. Priyam Vada Gopal. So Priya, we've seen in the aftermath of the Brexit vote a real, what seems like at least, an upsurge in hideous xenophobic taunting and violence. But let's talk about the run-up to the vote. There are some people on the left who supported Brexit who are trying to downplay the role that immigration and xenophobia played in the campaign. Is that fair?
No. The referendum is something, I should say, that should not have happened at all. It was actually brought into being with the Tory party leadership trying to appease the right wing of the party, which in turn was worried about the rise of the UK Independence Party, or UKIP. And it was really a response to a handful of aggressive and very loud Eurosceptics in the Conservative Party. The referendum was announced, and really not very much was made of it until the last 6 to 8 weeks, when it became clear that the referendum would happen and people would have to take a stance on it. And that's the point at which, when people were aware of what's going on, rather than a complicated or substantial discussion on the EU or on Britain's relationship with the EU, it turned into a referendum on immigration. So really what I'm saying is it was put into place, it was instigated by xenophobic elements in the Conservative Party and the UK Independence Party, and it became what I think it was always slated to become, which is a referendum on immigration. It was nominally focused on the question of British democracy and who made the laws for Britain, but even that was veiled xenophobia, in the sense that it was framed as rule from outside versus rule from within Britain. So I think that to suggest that immigration didn't play the central role in the way in which the referendum was framed is I think, at least slightly mendacious.
Well, I've been struck by, you know, the claims that the claims for democracy, that things are being imposed upon Britain, when, you know, neoliberalism and austerity have been imposed by people named Thatcher and Blair and Cameron, and had, you know, no fingerprints of Brussels on it to speak of. And I've really found it very hard to anybody to enumerate the ways in which the EU has really stepped on British sovereignty. Am I wrong? I mean, you know, I'm not there, so I don't experience it directly.
I know you're not wrong at all. One of the remarkable things about the way in which the referendum and the systematic campaign of disinformation around it was framed, and I have to say both on left and right, is one where the binary became the EU representing neoliberalism and austerity and British democracy playing the underdog, and very little discussion of the ways in which austerity and sort of the long tradition of neoliberal structural adjustment being very much a homegrown tradition. I think the people who were for Brexit were extremely successful in painting Brussels as the originator of everything from austerity to authoritarianism to extremism. So, you know, it became this kind of remarkable binary that had no relation whatsoever to actuality or to history.
Considering the way that Britain has played the role of the partner of the United States in promoting neoliberalism around the world, this seems especially disingenuous.
Yes, it was. I mean, it was deeply disingenuous is, again, the milder word for it. As people have been pointing out, if the people who've been selling Brexit had been selling a product, litigation would have been possible, because really we're not talking about rhetoric or persuasion. We're talking about outright lies and an outright suppression of the historical lineage of austerity in Britain and Britain's own historical relationship with the European Union.
Now, this has been a fraught history from the first. Right? The populist press, the right-wing press, has really been hating upon the EU for a couple of decades,
yes,
hasn't it?
Yes.
What are the roots of that exactly?
My guess is, in fact, that it is exactly the opposite of the way in which it has been framed. To the extent that there are environmental protections, labor regulations, workplace health and safety guidelines, much of that does come from the EU, and much of that is signed up to by EU member states. So in fact, what we have is the kind of the more vicious edge of British neoliberalism, and of course, Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch from outside, who don't even want the semblance of what little economic, environmental, and labor legislation there is. So, in fact, the painting of the EU as the neoliberal bad guy it's pretty much the opposite. Now, nobody in their right mind would suggest that the EU was anything but neoliberal. But the idea that the EU is the vicious edge of neoliberalism and homegrown British democracy protects the people's rights. That was a very clever inversion of the actual situation, and it worked tremendously well.
You know, we've been talking on Facebook about the way in which the Brexit people have been pointing to a British past as their guide star. Talk about that. Who are they looking at, and what role has it been playing?
I think that what they've been looking at is an indigenous tradition of radicalism and of democracy from below, which England and more widely Britain does have, as does every other country that I know of. But the problem is that it's been domestic radicalism has been taken up into a kind of quasi-ethno-nationalist narrative, whereby even people on the left, on the progressive left, people who might consider themselves anti-neoliberal, seem to be buying the notion that whatever is good and valuable and democratic has been homegrown, and that what comes from outside is austerity and anti-people measures. And what's been lost in this entire picture is the way in which British radicalism, the British liberal tradition, British progressivism has always been in a dialogue with the outside, has always responded to pressures from the outside, including from the colonies when Britain was an empire. So I think this what's turned up again is this very peculiar binary between the insular, literally off the island traditions, and traditions which come from outside. And any sense of a dialogue between the two has been severed in the discussion.
Was there a role for nostalgia for empire?
Very much so. I mean, there are scholars who have argued in recent days that, in fact, the longing to sever ties with Europe and have what has been euphemistically spoken of as closer ties with the Commonwealth is in one sense a harking back to the moment when Britain was top dog, which in the EU, Britain is not. Britain is one of them, was one of the more powerful countries in the EU, but it, you know, certainly wasn't top dog. And I think that there was a sense that returning to the old so-called Commonwealth relationship with the former colonies was the way in which some people in Britain wanted to position themselves. Now, of course, there's also very real economic free trade thinking that's going on here, the idea that India and China will provide more lucrative markets, will provide more lucrative business opportunities. So it isn't just imperial nostalgia, but I think that it has been framed in that way, certainly for a substantial number of people who did vote to leave. I read today, for instance, that Britain is now in a, should Britain leave the EU, which it will in due course, it's in a better position to have good arms deals with India, for instance. You know, it won't be fettered in quite the same way. So yes, there is very much a sense of turning away from the EU and trying to recover something of a lost past.
Is there any evidence that the former colonies are returning the affection?
Not really. I've only seen some responses from India. I think that the former colonies are by and large befuddled, not quite sure what the EU is or what Britain's role in the EU is and how this might affect them in the future. But I certainly don't see any sense of great joy or a sense of opportunity produced by Brexit as yet.
And what about the special relationship with the United States? Did that figure?
There's been some discussion of the relationship with the EU being replaced by Atlanticism. It hasn't figured very much in the sense that it's been figured in Britain. Brexit has been figured as Independence Day. Now, it's a little bit unclear who the independence is from. If you ask people, it's framed as independence from Brussels, whatever that might mean. America hasn't figured a great deal in the discussion. There's been some talk of how leaving Europe will protect social democracy in Britain, including some of the, you know, the more deleterious aspects of the TTIP. But of course, what nobody's really talked about is the fact that Britain can still be affected and be part of the TTIP, whether or not it's a part of Europe. So America has been on the fringes of this discussion, I would say, but there hasn't been very much openness about exactly what this will spell.
Now, it's been interesting to watch some of the leading supporters over the last couple of days, like people like Boris Johnson, kind of retreating from the initial promises that they were making, admitting that the £350 million a week that was going to go to the NHS was a fantasy, and that maybe we won't go so fast, maybe we can make it to, like, I don't know, like a partial separation. I mean, it's like then now they seem to, they almost as if they launched the thing just as a publicity stunt, and now that it's come to pass, they seem to be running away from it.
Yes, I mean, I think it's very clear that people who were prominent in the Leave campaign, including Johnson and Michael Gove, were absolutely clueless, and they certainly did not have a morning after plan. And in part, this is because I imagine they didn't necessarily expect to win. In part, it's because certainly on the Johnson's part, it was a naked political maneuver. Johnson has not been known to be a Eurosceptic. His newfound embrace of Brexit is, I think, very patently a political move, and it's paid off. He will, it looks like, be a serious contender for the leadership of the Conservative Party and therefore for the prime ministership. Well, I think there's also a problem in the sense that there's a certain degree of buyer's remorse we are hearing about in Britain, that a lot of people who did vote to leave actually didn't know what they were signing up to. And I think that the Leave campaign is itself divided between the far right, people like Nigel Farage and the UKIP, who want an extreme right break from Europe, and then people who really did only embrace Brexit for political calculations and actually are not quite sure how to play it now that the situation is very uncertain.
I'm speaking with Priyam Vadagopal, who teaches in the English department at Cambridge. One of the claims of the left Brexiters, the Lexiters, is that this was a cry of protest from the working class. What do you make of that?
I think there are many flaws with that argument, and really I could go on for a while. The first thing I want to say is that if you crunch the numbers, which a young scholar I know has done, it turns out that actually it's not quite true that this was the working class revolt that it has been painted to be. So, for instance, we know from the Ashcroft poll, which was done in the wake of the referendum, that a larger percentage of the upper and middle classes voted to leave than of the working classes. So we also know that a greater absolute number of upper and middle classes voted to leave than the working classes. So there is a question as to whether this was indeed, even as far as the numbers go, whether this was a working class protest. But as far as austerity goes, the argument that this was an anti-austerity, anti-neoliberal vote, that simply doesn't hold up, because we know, for instance, looking at the polling patterns, that the places that were most affected, for instance, by immigration, didn't necessarily experience problems in wage fall, in housing prices, and immigration presence. So again, there's no clear correlation between the critique of austerity, bitterness about austerity, and voting leave. It seems quite clear, given the way in which the campaign was run, that the vote was to reduce immigration. And we know that some people who went into the polling booth and were asked whether Britain should remain or leave thought that they were being asked whether immigrants should leave the country. So it seems to me a very odd correlation to be making, because the campaign was not very explicitly about austerity.
I know from the U.S. data, and I think it's pretty much the same in Britain, that immigrants tend to congregate in economically dynamic areas, like big cities like New York, Los Angeles, London, and shy away from the depressed regions, but the depressed regions where there seem to be the most anti-immigrant.
Yes. So again, you see that there is actually no correlation between a high presence of immigrants and a leave vote. This puts paid to the argument that the presence of immigrants has changed conditions as far as housing benefits, wages, and jobs are concerned. And that was the key plank of the Leave campaign, that immigration was affecting housing benefits, wages, and jobs. But again, there's no correlation between the places where there's a high immigration presence or a high migrant presence and voting to leave.
So it seems really that a lot of the anti-immigrant sentiment is not about labor market competition and the like, but really anxieties about cultural purity.
I think that's very, very clear. Something I read recently pointed out that actually the sense that immigrants are swamping the small island and there isn't place for everyone is actually pretty much a constant in British cultural life. So it was true 60 years ago when there were far fewer immigrants than there are now. But the rhetoric of a small island which cannot take the numbers has not itself shifted. The other problem with the idea that this was a protest vote against austerity is that it's actually unclear that people who voted were voting against austerity. There was very little discussion of austerity per se. The debate was repeatedly framed in terms of immigrants and their impacts on wages, jobs, and housing. So if it was an austerity vote, then that's a reading that you would have to read back into the referendum. It's not something that emerges from the data that's out there.
And the immigrants in question, were they South Asians? We're talking Poles and Romanians, Syrians, Jamaicans? Who are the immigrants that the ire was directed at?
The ire is so diffuse that from what we can see, it's directed at anyone who is perceived to be an outsider. We've just heard of an appalling incident involving an American who was on a tram and got abused and told to get out of the country. And I know several people, both white non-British people, as well as British non-whites who have been subjected to racial and xenophobic abuse in the last several weeks. There is no particular target. Now, the rationale given by the Leave camp was that the EU meant, which it did, free movement of people, and that the EU had spelt greater numbers of immigrants coming in from Eastern Europe, as well as what was very subtly made out to be people coming in from Muslim countries bringing in extremism. But there was no rational laying out of what the immigration patterns are, who that is affecting, and what the correlation is between immigration and perceived disenfranchisement.
Yeah, I watched the clip of that incident in the tram. It was appalling. But that kind of thing is now seems to be the new normal.
Yes, it's rampant. I've had a couple of incidents myself in a city which I live in, Cambridge, England, which 75% voted to remain, and it's a liberal university town. But I've had a couple of incidents in the last month, and pretty much everybody I know who in any sense can be seen to be an outsider has had some form of anything ranging from bad behavior to active racial hostility.
I've seen some Lexeter friends claim that this is really no different from what went before. We've always had these sorts of incidents. Does it seem there's been an actual increase?
Yes, it is very clear that there has been an increase. I think we're still waiting on the numbers, but from what I understand, some of the police forces in Britain are reporting increased numbers of hate crimes being reported to them. It's early days yet, you know, so we don't have all the numbers. But both anecdotally and in terms of what I'm seeing reported via social media and in news reports, the numbers of incidents and also the kind of language that is being used very openly has changed and has increased. I don't think that there can be very much doubt that in the last 6 to 8 weeks, the mood in terms of xenophobia and racism has changed for the worse.
You spent a lot of time in the United States. How do the attitudes towards immigrants in the U.S. Compare with those in Britain?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. I mean, it's been more than 15 years since I left the US. I think when I first came to Britain, I was struck by the relative lack of everyday hostility. And I think perhaps compared to places that I'm familiar with in the US. But again, I've tended to live in progressive university towns. So, you know, those are not very good barometers of how race and xenophobia work. But when I first came to Britain, I was quite struck by how relatively multicultural and relaxed things seemed around issues of race and immigration. And that's why I also say what I'm saying about how things have changed in recent weeks. For someone like me, there has been a palpable change in atmosphere. I think in the US, things depend on where you are. And I think while that's true in Britain, Britain is much smaller. And I think that, you know, if you set aside London, it tends to vary a lot less than it does in the US.
So then what set all this xenophobia off?
I think that it is resentment at a depressed economic situation, resentment at working conditions being terrible, resentment at a huge divide, economic divide, being fairly neatly displaced onto the bodies of the people who have nothing to do with it and who are in some sense vulnerable. If that sounds crude, it's because it is crude. I think that resentment about austerity, resentment about economic inequality is being displaced onto the wrong targets. But that is not saying the same thing as that this is an anti-austerity vote. If anything, it's taken the attention away from those who are doing the real imposition of inequality and austerity and neatly displaced the anger onto people who are much more vulnerable.
Now, of course, the consensus opinion is that the British economy was likely to enter recession because of the shocks of the last several days. Who knows? But it's quite possible. Chancellor of the Exchequer Osborne was saying earlier today that Britain's going to need some austerity, some spending cuts and tax increases. So that sounds like it's going to make it all worse.
It is going to make it all worse. And I think the real question is going to be, who are going to be the next set of scapegoats? Because things are going to get worse. And this is the sense in which the changed racial atmosphere is worrying, because although some people are trying to say, well, this is just a temporary tension around the referendum, it seems to me that if the economic situation does get worse, as it almost certainly will, then we're going to actually see exacerbated racial and national tensions. And I think we're going to see a lot more anger, and we're going to see a lot more of that anger displaced onto the wrong targets and the people who are imposing austerity and who are going to use this as a kind of Trojan horse for more neoliberal policies are going to get away with it once again.
We could all make a long list of things that are wrong with the EU. I've been doing it for years. I'm sure you have too. But is there anyone now speaking up for the principle of the free movement of people and the lowering of national borders? It just seems like the only opposition to capitalist internationalism is this reactionary nationalism.
There are not yet very many prominent voices. I think that the Remain camp failed in a variety of ways. while there are people in the Remain camp making the arguments about the economy and people from the Remain camp making arguments about, tolerance and openness, there has yet to be an explicit defense of the principle of the free movement, not just of labor, but free movement of people. And where that's going to come from at this point remains unclear. As you will know, the British opposition, the Labour Party, is in shambles right now. And instead of seizing the opportunity to make the case for Remain and make the case for a free movement of people, they're busy having turned on their current leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and busy trying to bring their own leadership down. So if you're asking me whether there are prominent voices making the case for the continued free movement of labor and keeping borders down, I'd have to say no, not yet.
That was Priyam Vadagopal of the English Department at Cambridge University. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more of Fear and Beer, Hymn for Brexit, by the Mekons, posted to YouTube on Wednesday. I'll read the note below the video again. Here is a hymn for a post-factual democracy sung joyously by the disenchanted and forgotten as they tumble teary-eyed into the arms of their oppressors. Till next week, bye.
Dismal men in dreary sea towns buzz around like flies. Someone said, we know what you're thinking, try this on for size. Deep and still, blood on the pavement, sticks and stones, hold them in your hands, a pint of fear, then home by tea time, for we